All right, thank you. Yeah, so let me start by thanking Jaroslav for asking me to give a presentation here. So I guess the idea is that this should be some kind of discussion, but it depends, of course, how much interactive it will be. It might just turn out to be an ordinary seminar. depends on you. But there will be some, we'll try to have some, present some open problems, and I think that will mostly come towards the end during JJ's part. But I will start reviewing some things here, and yeah, I think the title, it roughly reflects what I'm going to say, but we're going to say maybe a lot more than what's in the title. So that's the more in the title. So in some part, I'm not going to go through all the details, but I'm going to review the result, the main results, and so on, and open problems. And in some sense, I'm just going to continue from where Oliver left off on Wednesday, because he had a very nice review of many of these aspects. But let me just start by something, just to frame the discussion. So we've known for quite some long time that gravity theories have something to do with young Mills, even at weak coupling. And often we think of that as being saying that gravity is a double copy of the young Mills. So we write it something like this. And we saw that during Oliver's talk, right? And we also know that this is generalizes to supergravities, that we can think of super young Mills product with super young Mills to get supergravities. And of course, this has been known for quite some long time, and this goes back to Coilwell and Tai, and this is from 86. And this works very nicely. It comes from string theory, and it works for n equals to 1 all the way up to 8 supergravity. Of course, there's also some other states when you look at, for example, the pure theory. So there's going to be, in addition to the graviton field, there's also going to be the mu nu and the dilaton. And that's the same thing if you look at n from 1 to 4, sorry, 1 to 3, there's also some extra states. It's not just the pure supergravities. But if you have enough supersymmetry, you get the pure supergravities. So what's really not new since then? Well, so a couple of years ago, almost a decade ago, we got some new understanding for how this works. So this was 08 and 10. So the results in this work was that we managed to reformulate the KLT double copy in terms of, well, we can say it's a local QFT understanding. So what do I mean by that? Well, we managed to reformulate it in terms of local objects that we call the kinematic numerators, which are a product. And then we have just manifestly the right poles, and we're summing over all the cubic diagrams. So that's basically our gravity amplitude.
So another way of saying is somehow got rid of string theory.
Well, not really, but it's just a different way of thinking of it. And this is more useful for QFT, I think. I mean, string theory is very useful, of course, thinking about how it works on the Weyl sheet and so on. But once you take the field theory limit, it's not really obvious how, you know, string theory, you know, imposes these relations at field theory level. I mean, there's been work by Svi and Grant trying to do this at the Lagrange level. And this is many years ago. And, you know, you get stuck at 5 points or something like that. So you don't get very far. And now, of course, there's actually much better understanding on this. And this goes back to work by Clifford Chang and Grant. But I'm not going to discuss that. But we have a better understanding of it. Also, we have a generalization to loop level. Which is basically just putting an integral. It works the same thing, same way. It's not not very different. Maybe there's some symmetry factor, but otherwise it's the same structure. And we saw this also in Oliver's talk. So this is our loop level amplitude. At L loops. Finally, we also have some, we can call it maybe symmetry, but I put it in quotation marks. I think it's better just to say it's a Lie algebra understanding. So that has to do with the kinematic Jacobi relation that Oliver reviewed. So we have three-term identities that looks like the following. And these are basically just the equivalent identity that you would have for the color Lie algebra, but now it's acting on this kinematical objects. So we have some Lie algebra understanding, and ultimately that suggests that there is some underlying kinematic algebra that encodes these numerators, but we don't really know what it is. So that's one of the open problems, to actually find this kinematic algebra. So that's a very concise summary of the this understanding that we got in this work. Since then, it's been, of course, more work, and this is related to CHY and ambitwisters, so let me just say something about that. So CHY in 2013, and there was, I think Mason and Skinner had a paper on ambitwisters, which I think was the first one. It was one of the more important ones, I should say. Scattering equations formulation and ambitwister string. Understanding. So in some sense, the properties that were observed here was translated into some understanding back to some well-sheet understanding or some field theory living on a Riemann sphere or the ambitwister string. And that led to very explicit formulas. So these formulas here are not very explicit because there's always a problem of finding the kinematic numerators. But here was some explicit formula which actually computed this amplitude. And recently this actually has been used, CHY has been used to actually compute these numerators in many cases, and that's led to some very nice formulas. And then also simultaneous to this, there was lots of work by Stefan Stieberger and Oliver and Carlos Mafra. So Mafra, Stieberger, and Slaughterer, and also together with Bradle. So that's new string theory construction. Including what was mentioned in the talk on Wednesday, that even the open string can be written as a product of two different theories, one being Yang-Mills and another being Z theory. And then there's also been work by Stieberger and Taylor related to this roughly around the same time. And there's, of course, the Z theory paper by Carrasco, Afra, and Slaughterer. So all of this, I think, has led a lot of new developments, and also the string amplitudes are much better understood, especially at tree level. Okay. So much for the introduction. So then I want to get to this question that I've written here. So we've seen a lot of structure, and we've actually seen a lot of different gravitational theories and also non-gravitational theories, but I'm not going to discuss that. But we've seen a lot of theories which are double copies of, in the gravity cases, double copies of gauge theories, right? So is it possible that all of them could be double copies? Well, today we don't really know. There's a lot of evidence hinting towards that, but we don't have a clear answer to that. But let me try to just say something about the reverse statement. So if you have two gauge theories, and you try to construct the double copy according to the formulas that we saw, did I just erase, or the KLT formula. So you have two gauge theories, and you try to construct it. Will this always give a gravity theory? And the answer is no. This is not automatic. So there has to be some consistency conditions. And this is also something that Oliver mentioned. So what you need, well, let me say here, so not all let me put it in quotation marks because they are not valid. So not all of them are valid. And the way we can see that is because, for example, when you use the KLT formula, we have something like that. We have a vector of n minus 3 factorial Yang-Mills or gauge theory amplitudes. And then we have the KLT kernel, which is a n minus 3 factorial by n minus 3 factorial matrix. And then we have the other gauge theory amplitude. So this is only involving n minus 3 factorial partial ordering. So it's not automatically crossing symmetric. So this construction is not automatically crossing symmetric. Also, all the poles are not automatically the double pole. There's some double counting of poles on this side versus this side, and these are not automatically canceled out, right? So in order to actually make sure that this is well defined, what we need is that each gauge theory amplitude needs to obey what's known as color kinematics duality. And in fact, both of them have to obey it, but only one manifestly. So they have to obey color kinematics. Duality, which is basically this kinematic Jacobi relation, which is dual to the color Jacobi identity. And this is equivalent to obeying what's known as the BCA amplitude relation. at tree level, at least. So that's a consistency condition, right?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is it true in the other direction?
Well, that's the interesting question, of course, whether all gravities can be factorized in this way. That's a difficult...
Well, or I actually meant different directions. So you say that it must obey that, but is there... does it just mean that the random theory doesn't square nicely?
Yeah.
There can be some theory which doesn't obey that still does it, or not.
I should be a bit more specific here. What I mean here is that if you have, first of all, a vector field living in that joint, and all the other matter particles also in that joint, right, then you need this. And you can show that that has to be the case just from gauge invariance, that if you don't do this, the product will not be gauge invariant, and also that means that you're going to get a lot of garbage into your amplitude, and that might violate all sort of properties, including the ones I mentioned, having double poles and having not crossing symmetry and so on.
So the gauge invariance already forces that.
It's maybe it's a bit more because the starting point of this discussion is always, well, from my point of view, the starting point is always this formula. Which is summing over all cubic graphs and taking products of local objects. And this is already, from the very starting point, it's basically a local object which you write poles, and it's automatically crossing symmetric because it's summing over all the channels, right?
Right, but if I'm happy with some higher derivative gravity with not 1 over b squared poles, but over b to the 4, I'm just asking that it must be gauge invariant.
That's a good point. I think that the answer to that question is not completely known. I will talk about something like that during the conference, actually. I will talk about a series which has unusual poles, so conformal gravity in particular.
So I was wondering what you mean by all gravity theories. I mean, just classically, we can take, you know, GR and couple it to any matter. There's a bunch of scalars with arbitrary potentials. Are you asking whether those theories can be written as a product of two other?
I'm asking, so any theory which has a spin two particle, which
coupled to anything else?
Yeah, coupled to any matter, yeah. Of course, you can always just, you know, take the amplitudes involving just a spin two and ignore all the matter. And then you can say, argue that, well, that should naturally be a double copy. But the question is, once you include all the matter as well, because I think the point here is that we want to simplify our calculation for all the amplitudes in a gravity theory. And then it's not good enough if you can just simplify certain and not other ones. So we want the whole S matrix to have this property, not just the gravitational part of it, right? So if there's a matter, that should also be some double copy.
But is it even obvious?
I just wanted to know if you had something to say about, clearly, Yaroslav asked about higher derivative things and other kinds of poles, but the spurious poles have played a big role, but this really depends on locality. We know that this kind of local poles really locks you into the Feynman expansion, which is not especially efficient. Do you have a good understanding of what happens if I allow the propagators to be shifted by complex amounts and perhaps like that you would see in BCFW or?
No, I don't have any good comment related to that. I mean, all I can say is that most theories that we do consider have this form, right? And there's just a very few theories that anybody would consider which would not be on this form, conformal gravity being one of them.
Yeah. Of course, Yang-Mills, we understand locality.
Yeah.
But it's very convenient to use use representations for which locality is not manifest
term-wise. Yeah. No, I mean, the fact that you start from this doesn't exclude other ways to write it, but it just means that underlying the amplitude, there is a local way to write it. I think that's probably true of all the physical amplitudes, all physical theories, or that we normally consider.
As a mathematical statement, this is quite empty, right? It's just saying you have two copies of things which has local poles, and they satisfy a BCFU relation. And then you take KLT kernel, you get something that's crossing symmetric and also has only local pole.
Yeah.
So if I throw in some garbage, you double copy them into garbage, right?
Yeah.
So it's really like you ask two copies to be really gauge invariant, and then
you certainly need.
Not just gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant and local, because for example, if I take a leading singularity or something,
of course,
like a cut, it's Yang-Mean invariant, it's gauge invariant, everything's nice about it, but it sure as heck doesn't satisfy BC James that you can bind into a full amplitude.
Yeah.
Also, each copy is a sensible theory.
Can I also ask, so a priori, is it clear, because suppose that I take all gauge theories coupled to everything possible, and now I take like product of two different like non-diagonal things. Is it possible that it spans possibly all gravity theories? Are there more of that?
Well, that's the question, I guess.
But this is even without you construct anything. It's just like counting what you can couple to what.
Naively, of course, you can get everything. I mean, if you just look at the spectrum of the free series, you can get any other spectrum that you want. So the question is really in the details of the interactions. You really have to sit down and look through the interactions.
You are basically saying that the number of interactions in gravity theories is roughly square of the gauge theories, because if it is more than just square, you can never get everything.
Yeah.
There is few, for example.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if that's a well-defined counting, because in principle, we can just add.
Gravity Lagrangian, I want to get it amplitudes with that given Lagrangian, with that given coupling constants, I want to get it as a square. Then the number of these possible Lagrangians must be at most square.
I thought the point is that there are many things you cannot do this double copy, right? Like things
many
satisfied by BC theory. No, many gauge theory.
Yeah.
Gauge
indeed.
Theory amplitude. Yes. If you put in some higher dimensional operator, it may violate BC theory amplitude relation.
Yeah.
So those you cannot just plug in the formulas.
Yeah, but we're gonna reduce the number of things. Because the claim is that you can get
right. It's even smaller space.
It's even smaller space.
Yeah, indeed. I think that, I mean, the next point I was going to mention was actually gauge theories. We do not obey color kinematics duality. But it's an open question whether all the gravity theories can be constructed like this. And I don't know if it's so easy to do the counting, because you can, in principle, just, I mean, if you want to get some, for example, higher, well, you can also play around with higher derivative operators in the gauge theory, and that's known to work in certain cases. So there's a lot of freedom to play around. So this is not so easy to just, you know, sit down and count.
Yeah,
and
freedom and subtlety, right?
Yeah.
We're going to hear more about some additional subtlety in 2 weeks.
Right. So, okay, so let me then say, let me give you an example. So this is an interesting example where color kinematics duality is not satisfied. And I'm not going to show it, but I think it's fairly obvious when I say it. So this is a result from Chiodoroli, Jin, and Roiban from 13. So what they say is that if you combine color kinematics duality with a fermion in a joint, that actually implies supersymmetry. Okay, that maybe not be so obvious why that should be true. Well, we know that if you want to have supersymmetry, you put fermions in a joint, but the fact that it's exclusively true. But I think it's a lot more clear if you think about the double copy that you can do. So let's take Jang Mills and then take, let me take n fermions. Yeah, John.
Where is the, I guess color kinematics has got to imply the, I mean, Suzy's not just that you have the joints, but also the coupling is the same, right?
Yeah, no, so this is, so what these guys showed is that if you impose color kinematics duality for the four-point amplitude, you get certain Fierstead entities that has to be true.
Yeah.
These are exactly the Fierstead entity that's needed for supersymmetry.
Okay.
So imagine that we do this double copy. Whether it works or not, I mean, that's not obvious a priori, but let's assume that it works, right? Then we can see here that we have spin one half fermions here, and in this theory we're going to have vectors, so naturally we're going to get the product of these two things. So we're going to get gravitinos, right? So in this theory we'll have n gravitinos. And as we know, gravitinos are related to supersymmetry. So this n is, in fact, the number of supersymmetries. If this is a well-defined double copy, n is the number of supersymmetries. And of course, you can generalize that to the other side as well.
It looks like in this representation, you don't want n to be greater than 4. But
yes, indeed. Yes.
What if I put it at 8?
Well, so if you put it to be larger than what's allowed by supersymmetry, color kinematics duality can never be satisfied. Not when you have adjoint fermions. So, for example, it's pretty obvious here that if you don't have scalars, then n can be at most 1, right? So without scalars, even for n equals 2, this does not satisfy color kinematics duality. And if you have scalars,
using property of the supergravity theory to constrain this. Mm-hmm. The possible supergravity theories you can make.
Yeah. I mean, in hindsight, this is obvious, but it was really shown in the gauge theory first. So you see, once you have scalars, okay, at most you can n less or equal to 4 if you're in 4 space-time dimensions, right? And you can have that on both sides, and that gives maximum n equals 8.
Sorry, so there is some abstraction if you go to higher dimensions?
Yeah, indeed. So in particular, if you don't have any scalars, you can you can only have one fermion, and it only works in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions, right? And this is all well known. Yeah. Well known to be equivalent to supersymmetry. All right. So we can do the same exercise if we take scalars. In the joint and double copy with Yang-Mills. And then just by looking at the states, you see that you get a scalar times a vector. So what you expect is gravity plus, let me put an n here, n scalars. So you get plus n photons. And that's fine. This works. There's no constraints. And in fact, you can show that Yang-Mills plus n scalars will satisfy color kinematics duality, given that you have a phi-4 interaction in this theory. And this is sort of obvious, because that just means that this is a dimensional reduction of just pure Yang-Mills from some higher dimensional point of view. Yeah.
So is there any known example for a gauge theory with some color kinematics duality that has more than one color?
Yeah. No, so I'm going to talk about one. So Einstein Yang-Mills, for example, he has both the gauge coupling and the gravitational coupling, and additionally can have massive Ws.
So in this minimal example, you're going to get literally photons in the sense that you get U1 to some power.
Yeah.
But is there any way to bake in non-Abelian gauge theory?
Yeah. I will talk about that. Yeah. Right, so before I get to that, let me just say something about the next point here, which is factorizable versus non-factorizable. So right now, the one examples I've been looking at here is what we call factorizable. And this means that we put all the particles in that joint, and the gravity spectrum is literally the product of the states on each side. So the factorizable so the spectrum is basically equal to the gauge spectrum time tensor the other gauge spectrum. And this could be a different theory, so that's why I put a tilde over there. Which means that if you have n adjoint particles, and this could be vector scalars or fermions, and you have m adjoint particles here, then there's going to be n times m states in the gravity theory. And this is included including bosons and fermions. So that's basically the factorizable. And this is basically what KLT gives. KLT always gives the product of the two, the states on either side. But we understand that there are generalization of this, and this is what we call the non-factorizable. So in that case, the spectrum, first of all, we still need to have some gravitons, and that will still come from the adjoint. So the adjoint gauge spectrum times the adjoint in the other theory. So that includes a vector and a vector, which gives the graviton. But there could also be further states. For example, if you have a fundamental representation particle in the gauge theory, you can get the following states from this tensor product here, where you basically take the anti-fundamental, for example. It's not too important whether you take the fundamental or anti-fundamental, but it's a slightly nicer if you take the fundamental and anti-fundamental on either side. And then plus, it could be any representation. So representation R, tensored representation R bar, and so on. So these gravities also exist, and there's actually quite many examples where this double copy construction works. So this is different from KLT. This is not KLT. And in fact, it's an open question. So in terms of the numerator times numerator, the denominator is basically the same formula. But in terms of gauge invariant quantities, there's actually no known formula for this. So that's an open problem.
No closed formula.
There's no closed formula. Case. Yeah. Case by case, you can work it out, but there's no closed formula. So let me give you an example of such theory. The most obvious theory to consider here is just Young-Mills plus some fundamental quarks. So this is otherwise known as QCD. Well, according to me, I don't know. Other people might have different definition of QCD.
Where's David Gross?
So this is my theory. So this obeys color kinematics duality.
Are your quarks massive?
Yeah, great, thanks. So it works for massive or massless quarks. It doesn't matter which one you consider. So this was shown by Alexander Ashirov and me in 15. And so with this, you can construct many interesting theories. So for example, you can do the following double copy. So you can do n equals 2 super QCD. So this works for QCD in any dimension and whether it's supersymmetric or not. So you can do n equals 2 super QCD. And you double copy it in the way that I described here in terms of the states. So you do each, you do the adjoint separately, and then you do the fundamental separately, and so on. So you can do it with basically a higher dimensional QCD, and the dimension that I'm going to use is 7, 8, 10, and 14 QCD. So I just dimensionally extend it to some higher dimensions. So these are actually some well-known gravities, and these gravities are known as magical. N equals 2 super gravities. And I give four different cases here. So these four different cases corresponds to what's known as the real case, the complex case, the quaternionic case, and the octonionic case. So that's exactly four magical gravities, and they have something to do with the division algebras. And I think that's basically the origin of the word magical.
The second theory there, the fields still live in a four-dimensional space-time, but
yes.
The indices are extended over.
So this lives in four, or it could be extended up to six.
They live in the same dimension.
Yeah, space. But it's like a heterotic construction that you have to dimensionally reduce this side. Yeah. So to dimensionally reduce it down to six, or five, or four, or yeah. But one very interesting point about this is that this last theory here, this actually lives in 14 dimensions, and that makes it interesting because that's a counterexample to thinking of this as just coming from the string theory point of view, right? Because first of all, this is QCD, so it has fermions in 14 dimensions, so that's could not, can't come from the superstring nor from the open string. And in fact, it's well known that this last one, the octonionic medical gravity, also has no string theory interpretation currently. It's possible that there is some more complicated way of getting it, but the way that these other theories are gotten, this cannot be obtained the same way. And in fact, you can pick any dimension here, and if you pick any other dimension here, you get what's known as homogeneous supergravities. So this particular series here corresponds to symmetric targets, symmetric scalar manifolds, whereas for generic D, you have just homogeneous scalar manifolds. Okay, so now coming back to somebody, I think it was Jake asking me about gauging the photons, I guess, to get Yang-Mills. So let's try to gauge this Maxwell-Einstein theory. Oh, so I should say that these theories here, they're also Maxwell-Einstein theories, because they have lots of photons. And depending on which dimension you have here, you can have arbitrary number of photons. However, these theories, we don't actually know how to gauge them. So these are just Maxwell-Einstein theories, and we don't know how to gauge them in terms of double copy. Of course, from the supergravity point of view, it's well known how to gauge them, and often this involves R-symmetry gauging and so on, and that's something we don't understand. So that's a very interesting open problem. But this other theory that I wrote down before, which is basically Yang-Mills plus n scalars times Yang-Mills, this type of Maxwell-Einstein theory, this is very easy to gauge. And the way you do it is that you have to, in this theory here, you have to introduce a new self-interaction between the scalars. And basically, it's lambda phi cubed that you need to introduce. So I haven't really explained this, but these scalars here, they transform both under the gauge group. And if you have n of them, they also have a global index. So they're basically we can think of them as being a bi-adjoint scalars. It's the same bi-adjoint scalars as Oliver talked about 2 days ago. And since they're bi-adjoint, we can actually write down a cubic interaction in terms of FABC and the FABC of the global group. And it comes with some tunable parameter lambda. Lambda will be dimensionful, but after you've done the double copy, lambda will combine with the kappa of the gravity theory and form a dimensionless coupling constant. And this is going to be the gauge coupling constant in the gauge theory. So this, we call this Yang-Mills plus phi cube theory times Yang-Mills. So this is equal to Einstein, or this is equal to gravity plus Yang-Mills, which is what you call Einstein Yang-Mills theory. One thing I should point out is that once you have introduced this cubic coupling here, you cannot supersymmetrize this theory, because phi cubed cannot be supersymmetrized, at least not in an easy way. But on the other side, we can still supersymmetrize it. So this could be n equals 1, 2, and 4 super Yang-Mills, and that gives supersymmetric versions of this. And I should also say that this is very close to the heterotic string, that you have two different sides, one of them being bosonic, the other one can be supersymmetric. And in fact, as I said, this, in some sense, these scalars can be thought about as coming from some dimensional reduction. Exactly how you get the phi cube interaction here is not clear to me, but maybe somebody can understand it in terms of the usual string theory construction of the heterotic string. Okay, let me actually write down what this theory is, just so it's very concrete. So the action is the following. It's basically just ordinary F squared term. There's a scalar, so there's a kinetic term. Let me just write down the global indices. And then there is, as I said, it's important that you have a phi 4 interaction. That looks like this. And then you have a cubic interaction, which you can write as commutator as well. So A, B, C. And then the whole thing is a trace. So that's the theory. So it's basically, this is just ordinary higher dimension and the Young-Mills dimensionally reduced. Maybe there's a 1/4 here, which I forgot. There's a 1/2 here. So this is basically what you have in a supersymmetric theory here. But this term here violates supersymmetry. And I haven't, so this scalars also have a gauge index, which I haven't written out. Oh, sorry, this should be contracted. I forgot. So there's a structure constant here, A, B, C. And this is not the structure constant of the gauge group, but of a global group. So in particular, if you write it out in terms of joint indices, there's actually two different FABCs here in front of the phi cubes interaction. So this thing here is what people often called by a joint phi cubed. And I should also say that this term here is very important because this term here is needed to get multi-trace terms. Correct. You can see that this is actually a double trace term. It doesn't contribute if you look at single trace amplitude. And I should say that this type of construction was actually first written down by Svi, and I forget who was on the paper. This was 20 years ago or something. This was way before this was popular.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember either.
This was way before this was popular. But so you actually look at the single trace amplitude, and you didn't look at the double trace, and you didn't write down this interaction either. And this is needed to get the right double trace interactions. So you can show that this theory does not obey color kinematics duality unless this term is also included. OK, how am I doing with time? Probably not so good, right?
Are you just taking
Okay, can I take another 5 or so minutes? I was going to say something about how to construct numerators in this Einstein-Young-Mills theory. But I think in the light of time, I'll probably skip that. So what I will jump to directly is the symmetry breaking. This is a bit more interesting. So, because once we have Einstein-Young-Mills theory, we can actually consider what happens when you break the gauge group in the gravitational theory. So this is basically some spontaneously broken gauge theory coupled to gravity, right? So coming back to the first question, are all gravity theories double copies? Of course, we want to ask, you know, once you look at the theory, when it's spontaneously broken, is it still a double copy, right? Because we don't just want it to be a double copy when you look at, you know, flat space and where all the moduli parameters are at the origin and so on. We want to look at for different vacuums and so on. This still should be a double copy, right? So that's an interesting question. Is that possible? And naively, it seems like a very difficult problem, but the more you think about it, the easier it gets, actually. So I will try to explain it, and then at the very punchline is saying that it's trivial. And so what we're thinking of is Einstein, Yang-Mills, but we can also equally well think of the Yang-Mills theory itself, or the Yang-Mills theory coupled to the flat-cubed interaction. So basically what we want to do is we want to take this construction and we want to break it. So we have a spontaneous symmetry breaking, and in particular we want to go on the Coulomb branch, because there's no fundamental matter in this theory. So you have to think about it, and then it turns out that the right construction is the following one. You should keep the Yang-Mills sector the same in this theory, but you should break the global symmetry of this scalar. So let me just denote that by striking it through. So we have broken the global sector of this theory. And then on the other side, what you do is you break the gauge group of the Yang-Mills theory. You don't want to break the gauge group on both sides, because then you get massive Ws on both sides, and then that naively that will lead to massive gravitons, which you don't want to have. You only want to have massive Ws, and the way to do that is to have massive Ws here and massive scalars here. So the interesting thing about this construction is that it interpolates between a factorizable gravity. So this is factorizable. And a non-factorizable one. And so the way you can see that is by just looking at the spectrum. So let me just try to sketch that out. So here is the left theory, and here's the right theory. So a vector times vector gives a graviton. It also gives B mu nu and scalar dilaton, but let me not write that out. And then you get here this double cup between a scalar and a vector gives you a vector in this with this adjoint index here. So this is a factorizable theory because basically I get all the states that can I get from the double cup. Let me write that B mu nu as well. So you get all the states you can possibly imagine. But the non-factorizable is more interesting. So you have the vector, you have the massless scalar, but you also have in this theory here, you also have a massive scalar. Let me call it phi alpha. Put the alpha downstairs. And it's a complex scalar, so that's also the complex conjugate. And in the other theory, you have the massless vector. There's some vectors which remain massless after you have done the symmetry breaking. And then there's a W. And it's a W bar, the complex conjugate. So here, in this sector here, you still get the graviton, the B mu nu, and the dilaton. In this sector here, you still get the massless vector, mu A. But in here, you don't want to have a product between this state and that state, because this is a massive state, that's a massless state. So we say that nothing, there's no state that's produced by that product. Likewise here, Likewise here, this is massive, this is massless. So you only want to have states that survive when they have the same mass, which basically means that you're going to have it on the diagonal here. So here you're going to have W mu alpha, and here you're going to have W bar mu alpha. So in particular, the mass here will be zero. The mass here is zero. But for this state here, we want to say that this has a mass, and it's going to depend on which W you're talking about. So this can be parameterized by alpha, so mass alpha, m alpha. And then it's convenient. Well, normally we'd say that the complex conjugate W has the same mass, but it's actually very convenient to say that it has negative the mass of the W. It doesn't matter for any practical calculations because the mass will always appear squared. Likewise, here you have mass alpha and minus mass alpha. Okay, and this is clearly non-factorizable because the spectrum is not the square of the two sides or the product of the two sides.
So, Henry, how are you breaking the symmetry?
Oh, I didn't say that, but I'm just assuming that there is some VEV in the theory. The VEV will basically split up the adjoint representation. So if you start from your adjoint field, it will divide up into some fields which remain massless, and then some fields which pick up a mass. So I'm not specifying the details. I'm just saying that this is always going to happen. You're going to have some massless fields, some massive fields, right? And I'm going to think of them as Ws. I'm going to think of as being in some complex representation. In particular, the representation they are in is bifundamental, which is inherited from the original gauge group theorem.
But then this is not spontaneously integrating of the theory in the left, right? It's just some...
I didn't say anything about how it's broken. I'm just going to assume that this is pretty standard for, if you consider n equals 4 and the Coulomb branch, this is pretty much what you do. You say there's some VEV, and this has some consequence.
But one of the scalars can
appear. One of the scalars.
In your right theory, you don't write the scalars.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean in gravity? Well, in gravity, it's a lot more interesting, actually. So that I haven't explained. But, in the gravity theory, here's one scalar here, but you also have scalars. If you have a supersymmetric version, there's a bunch of scalars. And it's a lot more tricky how it's achieved. It's basically you have to, the thing is, you have a scalar manifold. You always have to parameterize the scalar manifold. You always have to make some choices. Certain choices correspond to having VEV. Other choices correspond to not having VEVs. So from the gravity point of view, the spontaneous symmetry breaking is actually quite natural. It's just a different choice of how you parameterize things. And it's extremely difficult, actually, to understand it. We spend a lot of time doing that, and it's a very complicated story. That's why I'm not telling it. It's very complicated. The gauge theory, spontaneous symmetry breaking, is a lot easier to understand. And in that case, it's just your ordinary say n equals 4 on the Coulomb branch story.
Higgs invariant.
Yeah, it's adjoint. It's an adjoint Higgs field. So we're not looking
at... So there's morally a scalar on your right copy next to your Yang-Mills.
Yeah, sorry, yes. Sorry. Yes, if it's just pure Yang-Mills, you can actually not do
right.
it.
I think that was the
yes.
scalar there.
Sorry, good, thanks. So I have to consider super Yang-Mills, but I can also consider just... Yang-Mills plus a scalar, which is just coming. So this is not that theory, but just coming from dimensional reduction of, say, five-dimensional Yang-Mills. And in fact, I'm sort of running out of time, but I think the punchline here. Let me say something more before I get to the punchline. So. Yes, so indeed, so there is a scalar. So thanks for pointing that out. And so this scalar has a VEV. Let me just write it as this. There's some dimension fault parameter V, and this is from the gauge theory point of view. And then it points in some direction, so there's some generator. Right. And it turns out that if you're looking at how does it break, you might ask, how does it break the symmetry? How does it introduce masses? And in fact, you can easily write down the mass matrix, and it has the following form. So it's a gauge coupling, this V here. And then you have an FABC, but it's a complexified version. So it's just FABC, it's just we're using complex generators. So let me denote it like this. So you can, for example, if you think of it as SUN, some generators are not Hermitian, but they're off diagonal. That's basically what I mean here. So there's a relation like this. And this is, once you diagonalize this, you find the masses of the states. But this is a very interesting relation because it actually says that the mass matrix is proportional to the column matrix. And in fact, if you diagonalize this, you can actually show that M of alpha, this is a diagonal element, this is equal to G times V times a charge. And this is a U1 charge. So there's a relationship between a mass and a charge. They're proportional to each other. And in fact, you might wonder, what U1 charge is that? Well, it's a coupling to this, the perturbations of this field here, how it couples to that. And that's actually well known that if you look at, for example, now I'm going back to the Higgs, the usual picture in the standard model. So if you have a Higgs coupling to, say, a top and an antitop, we know that the coupling here is proportional to the mass of the top, right? And that's actually what this equation is basically saying, is that there's a charge, and charges you put in a vertex, right? And the charge is proportional to the mass, so you should put in the mass in the vertex, right? Okay, and this actually explains why I introduced a minus sign here, because I want to think of it as being both positive and negative U1 charges. And in fact, what happens is that if you look through all the details, you realize that I can actually give my fields mass by just giving them on the external states, and then tracking through the diagrams for each vertex, there will be mass conservation, because this is a charge, so there will be charge conservation at each vertex. So in fact, I can give, I can just take like a higher dimensional Einstein Engels amplitude, say five dimensional Einstein Engels amplitude, and then I can give, so the W's, I can give them higher dimensional momenta on the following form. So first they have the four dimensional momenta, say, and then they have a mass. And this is pointing in the fifth direction, or the fourth direction, depending how you count. And likewise, if you have the W bar, what you would use is you would use a five-dimensional momenta on this form with a negative mass. And then for gravitons, or the remaining massless vectors, you would just use, say, four-dimensional momenta. So you put a zero here. So in fact, if you just take your five-dimensional amplitude and plug in this external momenta, at each vertex inside the diagram, there will be charge conservation, and therefore mass conservation, which means that all the particles will have the right mass. And it's all automatic. And in light of that, it's obvious that color kinematics theory holds, because we know that that holds for the theory when it's massless in five dimensions. The only thing you might worry about is, okay, how did this happen here, this projection out of states? And the way it happens is that you basically have to correlate the charge and the state on your external states. And that basically means that certain combinations are not allowed. So it's basically how you prepare your external states that actually takes care of this projection here. So I think that's the last thing I'm going to say. And unless there's any, there's a question, okay.
So if you think that W boson can consider energy scattering,
yeah,
would you be able to recover the Nemiskov model from this broken Young-Hills?
That's a very good question. I don't know how to do it, but maybe you know. Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, it's in some sense, yeah, the nonlinear signal model should be the effective theory of W. So, but I don't know how the details work. Yep.
Are there any cases where you can track spontaneous symmetry breaking as a higher form symmetry, like central symmetry, in gauge theory?
A higher form symmetry?
Yeah, like central symmetry or something.
Center symmetry?
Yeah.
What is that?
It's a symmetry under the center of the gauge
theory. Oh, okay. Oh. I haven't thought about that, yeah. But there are other symmetries, I mean, that you consider. I mean, so here, in particular, what I said is that we're actually breaking a global symmetry here. So that this is not the only, I mean, you can imagine generalizing this to other kind of breakings, yeah. So I guess JJ is going to say something more.
Yeah, so let's thank.
So we're right about here. So first of all, I should say that I'm not going to take a lot of time. I think I'm very happy that a lot of the time the discussion was spent on shell. As I said when I introduced myself to all of you on Monday, I really like scattering amplitudes. And so this is where we find a lot of concrete understanding that guides much of our consideration. But there's still interesting things to talk about off-shell. And so I'm just going to lead into some of this. And I'll mention some references as I talk, and I'll put it on the wiki page to make it easy for people to go check out some primary sources. And I'll introduce some of the things that I'm thinking about. I'm going to spend just a second talking about mass because one thing, I want to emphasize how beautiful this construction of spontaneous symmetry breaking in Higgs-Einstein-Yang-Mills is. What you see is charge becoming inertial mass and then through double copy directly becoming gravitational mass. And that's not always the story in double copies, but that seems to be the story that's happening, at least in Einstein-Yang-Mills. And I think that's very suggestive. But not all masses are created equal. And just to highlight this, let me remind you of something that Oliver introduced 2 days ago, which is the open string. The open string at tree level, its scattering amplitudes can be understood as a field theory double copy between supersymmetric Yang-Mills amplitudes. This carries all the R symmetry of the open string, and something which contains all the alpha prime corrections. So something that contains all the ultra soft UV behavior we demand from our finest theories is all contained in this object that that Aubier's field theory relations, these Kleist, Coif, and N-3 factorial BCJ relations. And it's a field theory double copy that generates the open string. And a natural question when you look at this, when you look at these scattering amplitudes, is where are the massive modes that we know are sitting inside our open string? Where are they living? And they're all living right here. They're all living on this side of the double copy. And we just heard from Henrik, at least in the case of spontaneously symmetry breaking, that when one double copies involving massive states, one double copies on massive propagators. But this isn't in terms of massive propagators. As Oliver described it, it was in terms of a KLT matrix, or you could look at it in terms of color kinematic satisfying numerators for each of these guys. And it's a double copy in terms of massless propagators on massless states. And so whatever massive modes are sitting inside here, right, they're sitting inside the open string, they're being double copied on massless propagators. So these massive modes are invisible to the double copy. And I just wanted to highlight it that there are questions in terms of mass. Well, I mean, so obviously, ontologically, these are in a very different class than sort of these U1 massive modes, this inertial mass dragging around propagators that we saw in Henrik's construction. These type of massless modes are going to be much more related to what we're going to hear from Henrik when he starts talking about conformal supergravity in the conference. So if you're interested in questions of sort of how more esoteric things are constructed through double copy, I very much encourage you to pay attention to Henrik's talk.
Is there any understanding of the Z theory amplitude in terms of this massive mode? Or at the moment it's just an alpha prime expansion, so you're dealing with massive?
Well, so that's an excellent question. Generically, the open string involves non-trivial Champaign factors, and so this guy involves a sum over, non-trivial Champaign factors and various Champaign orderings. For simplicity, I can talk about the abelianization of both sides with respect to Champaign factors, right? And I've still got color order, from a field theory perspective, I've still got color-ordered amplitudes on this side. And so let me just give you the four-point color-ordered amplitude for this. All right, so this is going to involve, from the field theory perspective, the double copy perspective, it's going to involve these channels, right, S and T. Our favorite inverse gamma function. So So you asked me to what degree we have understanding of these massive modes. Well, you can perturb around your channels, perturb around the infinite set of alpha prime dependent poles, and take residues in the Gegenbauer expansion of your other guy and check to make sure that the contributions are all of the same sign and that you're unitary. And so in the same sense that poking at this guy's scattering amplitudes at the level of dual models many years ago, you can see that these massive modes are there. These are infinite tower of higher spin, massive contributions sitting on the inside of our scattering amplitudes. But since there's no a priori story explaining Z, that's as far as understanding goes. I don't know if Oliver, do you have something else you want to say about the understanding of massive modes in Z theory?
So I guess it might be necessary to also include a double trace sector to Z theory to get all the factorization properties correct. So there might be something weird happening in the U channel in the expression here, which can be repaired by appropriate combination of the double trace sector.
Yeah, this is something still very much an ongoing discussion.
So I have a question. So how does this generalize when you have external and massive modes? Is there any idea?
That's a fantastic question. So one way of asking your question is, if I'm talking about open string scattering amplitudes with massive external states, does that factorize? Is that the question you're asking?
Yeah.
I have.
The question is to Oliver, probably.
Yeah.
I think it will.
Yeah.
Integral reduction, which was applied to the massless states, can again be applied. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the moduli spaces of disks and the dimension of that space, and it will again yield a double copy of kinematic factors and integrals. And it's an open question to study all the properties of these kinematic factors, whether the BCJ relation still holds, or whether there are some, disturbing minus signs every now and then.
Yeah, no, I think there's reason to be optimistic, but one should also be very careful, and I think it's yeah. I would say there aren't complete calculations that have demonstrated this.
Not beyond the four point.
Yeah.
But can I construct a consistent double trace string theory? This is something like a hydraulic string where I have gauge currents on both sides. Can I understand it like that?
I think it will amount to that, where one piece of gauge current is, say, the standard one from the heterotic string, and where a second copy of gauge current emerges, say, from compactification of a circle of self-dual radius, for instance, as implemented by Green and Kalle in 95. And this might put additional constraints on the admissible gauge groups that, in what JJ did not abelianize before.
Right. So at least this is one point I think that we can discuss further in our time together. Let me start moving forward so we can break for lunch at a reasonable time. So I like Anshel. I like scattering amplitudes, and I like invariant predictions. And I volunteer to talk about this side of things as almost a cathartic excuse to share some of the ways I think about the world with the rest of you. So for me, I think of gauge choices, and I'm including gauge choices, generalized gauge choices, by which I mean field redefinitions and all the uncountably infinite ways of adding zero to actions through spectator fields and the such. So I think of gauge choices as not only different ways of telling stories, but really different stories entirely, right? And in the sense, from a scattering amplitude perspective, my full color dress nonlinear sigma model, scattering amplitude might be like some color factor times a contribution of 1, 2, 3, 4, plus another color factor, 1, 3, 2, 4. Right, so this is one story I can tell about pions interacting quadratically and making a prediction. The gauge invariant predictions, right? This is what's true. This is what's true about a theory, and it's invariant about the various stories we could tell about what's behind it, right? But another way of talking about this prediction is in terms of a cubic burst, these particles that interact cubically. So I think one of the really interesting things about what we learned from KLT is that invariant on-shell predictions are related between theories, at least at the semi-classical level. And this is very useful. I mean, we used it to do many of our calculations, and we use it to gain insight about how various things come together. What I like about what's come out of the kinematic algebra, the color kinematic algebra, is that it sets up a framework that lets us know we can line up stories between theories that double copy with each other, right? And so, and this is an off-shelf statement about the fact that we can actually come up with descriptions in both the gauge theories and our gravity theories or nonlinear signal models. We can tell stories in a similar way that relate the stories off-shell. And that's very interesting. So there's a difference between, for me at least, there's a difference between relating predictions and having the chance of relating stories. Now, there's a gauge dependence here, right? We only get to double copy, right? I only get to turn this into special Galilean, so the even Galilean, so I get to replace CS with another copy, so each of these was a numerator over denominator of this graph, right? So now I get to do numerator squared over denominator. I only get to replace the color factor with a numerator factor if I'm in the right gauge, right, or generalized gauge, where I'm making manifest color kinematics. So I'm making manifest this kinematic algebra. But once I make this kinematic algebra manifest, then it gives me the opportunity to start pulling apart and putting theories together in various ways. So it's possibly, I mean, and if you have aspirations to telling stories that go beyond on-shell prediction, then it's very handy to have a way of starting to line up your calculations, to line up the ways you're telling your stories. And so this is what I see the role of the kinematic algebra. All right, so let me just mention, just actually, you guys, I don't have a clock on me. Can you, there are no clocks in this room, I've noticed.
11:50.
It's 11:50. What do you think? 10 minutes, should I spend 10 minutes? Okay, let me just go through quickly. So, all right, one of the sacrifices I'm gonna make is I won't write out all the names of the people I'm citing, but I'll say them as I write them on the board, and I'll definitely put them on the Wikipedia page. So allow me to move a little quicker. First, multi-loop integrands. This is the first place where making color kinematics manifest. So of course, after you integrate your multi-loop integrands, you've got an on-shell gauge invariant quantity, right? But the level of the integrand of individual graphs, you don't have on-shell gauge invariant quantities. You have all sorts of things you can add to your description in terms of total derivatives, in terms of what channels you're assigning various places, that they're absolutely not predictive until you either consider cuts, so take them to something that's gauge invariant or products of gauge invariants, or you actually integrate. But multi-loop integrands, using kinematic algebra as a guidance for lining up the stories, right? Jacobi's in the adjoint, or in the fundamental commutator relations and the spontaneous symmetry breaking. There's a beautiful seven term identity that shows up that are different than just the Jacobi identity. Lets you go after organizing the information contained in this off-shell data in such a way that you can then you can double copy and start talking about other theories.
So you mentioned after you integrate, you get some physical results. Do you see any double copy in the integrated functions?
Okay, so that's a great question. So are the integrals of single copy and double copy theories related? And
what structure would you be looking at? How would you say that the gravity result comes from a square of the angle?
Good. So
I think you need more technology. The integration technology isn't good enough. You know, we have our examples.
I know, some people are trying somewhat and need somewhat or want some motivation why you should integrate the gravity result at three loops, 4 points, say.
Good.
always integrate.
It's basically the question you ask. We know that the integrand is related. I can give you an example. Think about string theory. There's a Kobe-Nielsen formula. So in string theory, we know on line one that there's a double copy. Then you do the Kobe-Nielsen integral, and then lo and behold, the thing still is a double copy. Right? That's people have been saying here. Now you can ask, what about loop integrals? If you integrate something where you have a double copy of the integrand, it'll be integrated. What do you see afterwards? And the problem is, let's just say you pick some one loop example, and if you don't organize it properly, you'll never see the double copy. It's not something that you can easily disprove that it can't. Let's say you take a double copy of Yang Mills in one loop, and you start integrating it. You get some expressions, and then compare it to gravity. After integration, can you really see what's going on? I don't know. If you don't organize it properly, but the place you want to study this, I think, is low points, and of course super Yang Mills and. N equals 8 supergravity, N equals 4 superangles, N equals 8 supergravity. You try the one loops, a one loop, it works, right? The double, we know exactly after integration how it works. Two loops, it works. So three loops, doesn't work. And there, if anybody can do the integrals, that would be fantastic. You get a prize. Who can do the integrals? Can you do the
With Johannes.
Can you elaborate in what sense it works at one and two loops?
Trivial.
You say you see after integration the double copy.
Yeah, just trivial formulas because the one copy, each numerator is independent of loop momentum. So you get the same damn integrals, right? So it's manifestly the same thing. And you can then write down, after integration, double copy formulas. Max can write one down if you want.
In two loops, in the non-planar part, is the
numerator?
No. That's you don't want to use that representation.
Well, it's a total, So first of all, the integrand doesn't double copy, but it integrates to the same thing, which ends up being a double copy.
In N equals 4 super Yang Mills, 4 points, it works trivially or obviously in one loop, two loops, you write very nice formulas after integration relating super gravity to super Yang Mills, life is good. And the next example, the next simplest example would be three loop, 4 points. And the reason why you have to do 4 points is because if you try 5 or 6 points, you're going to be lost in some kind of a confusing mess of too many kinematic invariants and how exactly you're supposed to organize it. At 4 points, it'll either
jump out at you, or I mean, there you could at least disprove it. You can, you know, like demonstrate, look, this doesn't work.
I'm sorry, by here you mean double copying coefficients. The integrals are the same. Yeah. Oh, it's not double copying integrals.
After integral results,
that's not true for higher loop. That would be different integrals.
No, but you have to do the, you have to go to the basis of master integrals, and you have to reduce it, and you have to have structures. The integrands, the integrals you get on line one are not the same. But that's not the question. The question is, after integration, you know, you really reduce it to a basis of and you expect the final answers. Maybe even have to go to the polylogarithms to make sure you have independent functions. And then the question is the relationship between the two theories after integration. And if you could do that non-planar, you know, the window thing, if you can do that, you're a hero.
Yeah.
And then we can find out the answer.
I'm not the hero.
Okay, good. Then you're the hero. And then we can find out the answer to whether there's after integration, whether there's a double copy relation, and even disprove it. See, the basic problem isn't to prove it, it's to try to disprove it. Right? You want a case that you can study well enough, it's like science, like you'll have a definite answer at the end. Where if you can do the n equals 8 supergravity, 3 loops, you'll be able to prove or disprove whether there can be a double copy formulas after integration.
So, but double copy is meant to say that as coefficients of the integrals, you have products.
It can be
a finite sum.
Yeah, that there's a formula.
Have to be all together.
You look at this theory, you look at that theory, and you say, my God, why did I do the integral? I could have just, you know, had a simple...
Right, but it's a sum of things.
Yeah, a sum of things.
I mean, for the fourth one, don't have
to... Yeah, it'll be a sum of things.
But in general, it'll be a sum.
But you would need also some, because with the structure of holes, we have a guiding principle, you have cubic graph, but now you have just function. Unless there is some guiding principle of
rational in a sense, this is the entire problem. This is what you're going to look for. But because the problem is simple enough that the set of functions, polylogs, we understand them. Nothing will be hidden from us. So at the end, you'll be able to prove that whether there is a simple relationship or not.
I'm sorry, but for example, IR divergence. IR divergence in Yangon's is stronger.
That is actually not correct. That's a double copy. You can write in one of our papers. We have some formula for infrared divergence. It's how they double copy.
But it's stronger.
But that's because there's a momentum conservation. S plus T plus U equals zero. So that knocks out the leading singularity. But there's relation. Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of relationships, and we would be able to, if we had explicit formulas, we would be able to lay this to rest. You know, it's the right thing to do because you want something that, at the end, once you finish, you inspect it, and then you demonstrate it cannot be done, or hopefully that's not what you find, but you demonstrate that it can be done.
Or maybe the closed string at tree level could be a toy example of what could happen. Namely, as we heard from JJ, the open string is kinematic factors times integrals. And of course, the kinematic factors will double copy if you go to the closed string. And what do the integrals do? Naively, they double copy their KLP. But if you look at the net result after you see tons of cancellations, then the multi-zeta values are filtered. Like some of them are set to zero, like zeta 2. And others are just doubled. And as Tree mentioned, there are polylogs all over the place in loop integrals. So maybe it remains to figure out what the filter is for all the polylogs in those integrals.
Yes. No, that's an excellent point.
And maybe one more comment. This is actually pretty important because, you know, we spend our life constructing the integrand of supergravity, and then we have to go integrate it in the ultraviolet. But wouldn't it be nice if you just take the Yang-Mills, you just integrate that, and then you have a procedure, you know, some
generalized double copy, and then you just write down the supergravity, and then you're minimum. And then you prove that equals 8 supergravity is finite.
No, that's right. I was just going to mention, so besides Oliver's excellent point, let me just boost that for a second, that he mentioned that the closed string, which is the open string with this string theory penalty between open string amplitudes. So you've got lots of games between all sorts of you know, complicated disk integrals, yada, yada, yada. It simplifies to something that, again, you can express in terms of field theory quantities, like a mils, and some single-valued bits of what's in your Z theory on Z Yang mils. And these are just field theory products. And they're beyond the simple evidence at one loop or two loops where there's no loop dependence in places we really care, which is the UV divergence, the dimensions which n equals 8 supergravity diverges, which is the same as n equals 4 super Yang mils, the critical divergence, we see that exactly the same integrals on the supergravity side are what is part of the subleading trace terms of n equals 4 super Yang mils. And this is the type of structure that one might hope to see continue and might hope to understand more broadly than just in the critical dimension and the leading divergences. Where am I in time? Okay, good. Let me mention, okay, stepping away from strict scattering amplitudes, form factors. So, so Rutger Bowles, Kneale, Tarasov, Yang in 2012, for loop, Sudikoff form factors. So you have gauge invariant. So most generally, predictions for Yang mils observables you can write as dependence on gauge invariant operators and on shell quantities. Sudikoff form factors, you have one operator insertion, but so for loops, and then Gang Yang in 2016 did this for five loops. You can ask what this double copies to in the supergravity theory, and I don't know. I'm happy to talk with anybody about that. I don't know what a double copies to. Step away from Barron's Gill currents. So we're working our way up to the action. Barron's Gill currents. Oliver and Carlos Mafra and Lee.
Yep.
Lee, Mafra, Slaughter, and it was 2015, right? Showed that there was a nonlinear gauge transformation at the level of Barron's Gill currents that makes manifest color kinematics. So they called it BCJ gauge. Of course, they should have called it LMS gauge because they're the ones who found the gauge. And making things manifest at the level of the action. So I guess first perturbatively, I should mention Byrne, Denon, Wang, and H.I.J. Kiermaier. Good. This was in 2010. They showed that you could term by term add zero to the level of the action to start making color kinematics manifest. And so L Yang mils equals your original Yang mils plus a guy whose sole job was to assign your Feynman diagrams to make 5-point satisfy color matics, plus a 6-term guy, plus dot, 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 dot. And I guess in 2013, Weinzierl and Talati, so TW, took another look at this and sort of systematized one way of organizing such a perturbative generation of effective Yang-Mills theories, effective Yang-Mills actions that make color kinematics manifest. And each of these is manifestly zero just by Jacobi identities on the actual color factors of your gauge group. And so but let's try to hone in on the kinematic algebra, and I think there are two rather stunning examples I should point to. The first, I think, has been with us for a while now. This is Donald O'Connell and Ricardo Monteiro identified the kinematic algebra and the self-dual sector in Yang-Mills. And so Monteiro and O'Connell, and what was this? This was 2011. And they identified the kinematic algebra, and it was area preserving diffeomorphisms, and that at least gives something concrete at the level of the action you can poke at. And later, when they started trying to line up classical solutions, going to the self-dual case was a place they could jump up and down and at least talk about these stories as possibly being related to the type of structure that is very concrete and easy to identify on shell. And then I think much more recently, just a couple of months ago, Xiao Shen and Cliff, so Shen and Shen, 2016, for the nonlinear signal model, they were able to write down an action and a kinematic algebra that, at least on the equations of motion, makes manifest anti-symmetry and Jacobi on the support of the equations of motion. And this is fully at the level of the action, and they give these guys give one example of double copying at the level of the action by stripping off the gauge and replacing with another copy. But I think it's fair to say that the story started here is by no means over. I think there's a lot of interest in ways that people are poking around and taking the action they've written down and generating the spectrum of theories that we know that you can get by just double copying stuff with the nonlinear sigma model. I'm not going to talk too much about this because I assume you're going to be talking a fair bit about this and related subject matter at some point.
I don't know, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, well, we should make sure you do. Okay, where am I? I'm so out of time. All right, well, you know what? I'm gonna close up leaving this unsaid. I think there are very important open questions about what this on-shell double copy story, how this relates to holography, there are lots of hairs to pull on with regards to that. The reason you might expect that you can actually tell some of these stories off-shell in Witten diagrams, for say, you know, in either anti-de Sitter or de Sitter space, comes down to some suggestive work by our friends who have been looking at classical solutions double copying, and the fact that you can understand these spaces in some sense as double copies. And I think there's a lot of fun open questions from this story. We like classical stories. Classical stories are easy to tell. So I think with that, I'll close.
So we heard a lot about
getting many, many theories by adding stuff to one copy or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And now, especially when people are looking at these classical double copy, what they want is to get rid of stuff.
Ah, and you, and so and it's always best, always gets to go on shell. So some of the best ways to get rid of stuff is to talk about what you'd need to do to get rid of things on the level of scattering amplitudes. Like, let's say you want three loops, pure gravity, right? You don't want your, you've got pathological issues and you're allergic to anti-symmetric tensors and dilatons. So you just don't want them running around your loops. Can you get them by double copy? And the way you get them by double copy is by adding wrong sign matter to your Yang-Mills theories, right? So there are all sorts of games for both stripping away stuff and adding stuff. You're going to hear, I assume you're going to hear from Henrik, I haven't actually seen his talk yet, about very subtle ways of generating states in double copies that don't look at all like the product of spectra. But that you're absolutely right. There are all sorts of questions you're going to have at the classical level or beyond where you don't want all this stuff running around, and you want nice controlled ways of making sure it doesn't show up.
No, more quick comment. I think you can also do double copy at the level of the current.
Yes.
So that should provide you some very weird gauge of field recognition, some classical solution to Einstein equation.
That's right. And so, what's going on? Yeah. Yes, I absolutely agree. So one should not only be double copy for good stories. One shouldn't just be double copying your fields, but one should understand how sources and currents are double copying, and how that relates.
Okay.